Welcome to the Network Break. Each week, the Packet Pushers analyze, contextualize, and demarketize IT news and vendor announcements while sharing virtual donuts freshly harvested from our organic server farm. I'm Drew Conry Murray, Greg Farrow, and Ethan Banks are also here. This episode of Network Break is being sponsored in part by Nokia DeepField. Nokia DeepField provides real-time analytics and DDoS protection that helps service providers improve IP network performance, security, and efficiency. Find out more at Nokia.com. To the news, our first story, SDN startup Big Switch has partnered with HPE as part of HPE's open networking ecosystem. What's going on here, guys?
I think it's pretty interesting. You know, we talked about how software startups have a different path to market than companies who make hardware. You know, I've been banging on about that story for a couple of years now. And I think what Big Switch has done here is shown that if you're a software-only startup and you run on other people's hardware, so for example, Big Switch runs today on Edge Core Networks Whitebox, on the Dell Open Networking Series of switches, and now runs on the HP Alta line switches. And now they get the benefits of partnering with Dell, who sells their Big Switch. They can sell it direct to market themselves, and now they can add HPE. So now all of a sudden you've got, if you're trying to break into the networking market and fight against the, you know, the 80-pound gorilla that is Cisco, you've just enlisted Cisco's two biggest competitors and their hardware, given them a reason to sell your product and take it to market. I think this is a great move for Big Switch. You know, whether they won't become prime time with HPE because HPE is going to be selling Arista switches, you know, and that sort of stuff. So I think it's going to be fairly interesting to see how Big Switch pans out from here. We talked to them during the week last week. They've now got like over 175 employees just writing software. That's as big as a Cisco team writing software, right, for a specific product set. So they're starting to get good size momentum.
That's right. So the outline of the deal is HP is going to resell Big Switch's Big Cloud Fabric, which is essentially its data center SDN play, and Big Monitoring Fabric was essentially a network packet broker, and they will run on HPE's Alto line switches, which is sort of the white box, bright box, HPE branded gear. You've got your Tomahawk or Trident 2 ASIC offerings in there. I see this as being actually obviously good for Big Switch because having a reseller like HPE can be a significant boost to your company. Also, that sort of validation of here's a big organization sort of blessing this technology. And frankly, my take on HPE is that, yes, they sell hardware, but they're really trying to be a software company in that they want their software in terms of the data center to make using data center resources a lot easier, making it easier to roll out applications, whether it's containers, virtualization, et cetera. Big Switch is being a software-only company slots in nicely with that strategy.
Yeah, well, they have two products. One, which is the security product, which is the visibility or monitoring fabric product, and the other one is the data center networking. Now, I think it's going to be interesting for HPE as to whether they can get the attention of enough of the HPE sales reps to sell their products. That could be a really difficult thing to do.
To make a push on Big Switch, you mean?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what is it? But keep in mind that selling HPE Alta line switches might earn more margin for sales reps than selling Arista switches.
Right, yes. Which might make Arista feel a little bit snubbed, I don't know.
So, you know, to be snarky and cheap and nasty about the whole thing, but let's face it, that's what sales reps are. So if you had to make a choice between selling some Big Switch and you selling your own HP Alta line switches and getting that revenue, you know, booked in your books instead of passing it on to Arista, maybe that'll be a bit more attractive to some stuff. So I think it's interesting also. Resellers will be able to get deal registration. So if you decide to take Big Switch into an account, you then go through deal registration with HPE and Big Switch, and they'll give you all the help that you need to close that deal. So I do think this is quite an interesting thing. I mean, ultimately, Cisco is sort of, you know, shrinking slowly in the enterprise as it loses relevance, and it's got competitors that it can't take out. Like in the past, competitors used to try and be like Cisco. What we're seeing is that these companies that are competing in that space, they're not trying to compete against Cisco. Only Arista has done that, really, and done it with great aplomb, by the way. As we talked about last week, they had enormous financial results, way over the top. So customers are, you know, these vendors are coming out of the woodwork. They're competing with Cisco, but they're not doing Cisco. They're not trying to be Cisco or do it better than Cisco. They're doing something different, and that's what Big Switch is doing. And I think this sort of shows you that those solutions can continue to win, or they're still showing signs that they're going to win. Who knows what it'll look like in 6 months or 5 years, you know, whether Cisco can turn it around and start to take control of the enterprise market again. It's hard to say that that's working because Cisco hasn't really, you know, been able to defend its turf for the last 5 years. So we'll see how it works out. I think it's just a good move and not necessarily an obvious one.
That's right. And I also wonder if HPE has been looking at VMware's success with NSX and thinking, maybe there's something there, and then seeing Big Switch, which may not necessarily be an NSX competitor, but certainly offers some of the same functionality. And at the same time, Big Switch makes a big deal about how it can work with NSX and be sort of that underlay for the NSX overlay. So that also slots in nicely with HPE not wanting to piss off VMware as a partner and seeing more opportunity to play in the networking space without, as I agree you're saying, not having to out Cisco Cisco.
Yeah, I mean, every time HPE has typically been a very big channel partner for Cisco and sells a lot of it. And they've been very careful not to upset Cisco, but because that's where the revenue is. I mean, that's what customers have wanted. But what HPE is definitely doing here is taking a stand and saying, we don't necessarily want to be only offering Cisco. And I would imagine, just to put some thoughts out there, that HPE sells servers, and that's where its core business is. And every time they put a Cisco network out there, they're opening the door for Cisco UCS, you know, for the sales reps to come in and start offering Cisco UCS and saying, you know, blah, blah, blah. So they might be saying to themselves, you know, we really want to have a control of the account. We don't want the customer to have any independent thought or to do something that's not what we want. And, you know, just remember, customers, you don't actually own your network and, you know, your assets. They're there for vendors to just take and own, of course, right? So just remember that. So I imagine that HP definitely wants to get away from quietly, slowly, progressively over time, put the Cisco relationship as something that's, you know, something that's not what they lead with.
All right, moving on. The carving up of Brocade's IP networking portfolio is finally complete. The last piece, which is Brocade's open daylight-based SDN controller, is being spun out into a startup called Lumia Networks. Lumia is targeting service providers with a combination of an SDN controller and a services arm to help providers stitch together new solutions that are based on open source and proprietary vendor products.
How many pieces are they going to break Brocade up into?
Oh, well, a million.
It's like somebody dropped a glass on the floor and it broke into like lots of pieces, and they're going to put one in this bin and one in this. I kind of thought that when AT&T bought the Viata part, that the SDN controller went with it, but apparently not. So my bad. I didn't really pick up on that in the announcement. It wasn't clear at the time when AT&T bought Viata. I think I actually called out and said, I assume ODL, you know, the open daylight, the controller piece is going with it. But then again, obviously not. So Brocade had quite a lot of customers running open daylight. There is a business there. So presumably what they've done is just taken the people who've been doing the development work of, you know, packaging open daylight into a turnkey ready to go solution and turning it into an SDN controller, which has been selling quite well, I believe. It's not exactly NSX ACI sort of with the marketing dollars that they've spent telling everybody how awesome they are. You know, there's a lot of a perceived momentum there that may or may not be real. And, you know, we had a briefing this week from VMware telling us how big NSX is getting, and Cisco continues to blog a lot. But I think this is a good move for customers who've got the product, and also very good for open daylight. Having a commercially supported version of this distribution and a company that's not going to compete with everybody else means that if you wanted to run open daylight on top of other people's stuff, maybe Whitebox, maybe anybody who's got ODL support for their device, you've now got a solution where it doesn't necessarily conflict with your vendor. You know, you're not buying a controller from one company and switches from another.
That's right. And just to round this out, SDX Central's reporting that Lumia is getting approximately 200 customers, that there are approximately 200 people using this open daylight SDN controller. So not a bad start for a new company.
A lot of companies would be more than happy with that. A lot of SD-WAN companies, for example, that we have out there today haven't even reached that number of customers.
Certainly. And if they're going after carriers and service providers, 200 is a healthy number.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, definitely.
All right, the next story, Google has developed its own networking stack for routing over the public internet. It's called Espresso, and there's a really detailed article about it in the Next platform, and Google is using it for approximately 20% of its public internet traffic. They're just beginning to release details about Espresso, in part to publicize what it's up to, and in part to see, I think, if they can attract some attention from ISPs and other parties that might want to experiment or adopt with it. Here's some key points about it. The essential idea is that it takes routing decisions out of the router and puts it onto lots of servers to do the path calculation, and so the router just essentially forwards the packets. It's also trying to find the best path, so using metrics like bandwidth and latency and what the application might be that the packet belongs to, rather than just saying, I know this is an open and advertised path, I'm going to send it down here. They're looking to get cheaper, simpler, less expensive routers out of this, and they're toying with the idea of releasing official details about Espresso to encourage more adoption.
Yeah, so this is the fifth version of Google's private WAN. So they've talked in the article, they actually talk about B3, B4, and B5. I think the B stands for backbone. So, and I think you've got to remember that Google is just so out of the ordinary in terms of what it needs a network to do. And it's just carrying so much traffic that it has to be incredibly simple. And I think that's the thing that I took away from it here is the actual WAN itself is an incredibly simple thing. And what they're saying is that the internet doesn't work for them because there's too much packet loss. It's not the optimal path. They can't be certain that the traffic will go the best way from destination to destination. So they're building their own private WANs. Now, they're not the only big company to do that. Facebook started doing that. Dropbox has started doing that. We've seen a number of the big public cloud or public service companies start to talk about how they're going to run their own WANs and do them. There is some interesting information in here about how they're changing away from the legacy ideas of autonomous devices making decisions in the network itself and actually taking the decisions out. I imagine that they're doing something like segment routing from the host. So the host actually says, I'm going to send the traffic down here, and it uses an SR segment routing type model to say, I'm going to select this path. And underneath it, there is a network that knows these are the possible paths to the destination, and then it organizes a redundant pathing between the two endpoints. But I think the secret here is that Google knows that it's got to get to terabit and above bandwidth forwarding. And if they use the current sort of generations of routers that are out there, the processing load is going to kill them. So they need to distribute the load further and further to the edge of the network. And so that's what they're doing here. So lots of interesting information in here. Google's been publishing lots of details about this for quite some time. So don't be surprised. I didn't get a sense of surprise when I read it and saying, oh, yeah, no, that's unusual. I sort of went, oh, yeah, makes sense. But only if you think about it at Google scale.
I think what was interesting is obviously Google's put a lot of effort into optimizing its own backbone and its own private connections. And this is now an effort pointed at the public internet as opposed to networks they control.
Oh, well, they still connect to the public internet all over the world.
Of course, yeah.
But they have to make a decision as to whether they send the traffic to the internet or over the private WAN backbone. And they may even make a decision as to whether to route it over their private WAN backbone and put it on the internet somewhere else. So if they're going to send traffic from, I don't know, Silicon Valley to Singapore, do they traverse that over their private WAN or do they traverse that over the public internet? Maybe they want to route it, you know, for some obscure reason. They want to route it to South America and then drop it into the internet so that it gets to Singapore faster, because the global cables make sense. Like the way that the submarine cables work, it makes sense to route traffic to various destinations in a very flow-like or open flow-like model. That is, that's the fastest path to that set of destinations, so run it down that path. So, you know, they still have 90 pops and, you know, blah, 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 and just numbers that just, you know, boggle the mind. But I didn't, like I said, I didn't actually get a sense of like, wow, that's amazing. I got a sense of, yeah, logical progression from previous generations of networks.
I think this really goes after, you know, a different... BGP is what's connecting our internet, but it's not good at fastest path. I mean, we're seeing Espresso here, Google's customized solution to the problem of fastest path over the internet. And we, of course, have talked to Teridian before, and I talked to Experio recently, and there's this a lot of people that are going after this problem. So I think that's maybe the most interesting footnote here is BGP, the protocol we're all very familiar with, is great at connectivity, but the best path algorithm in BGP does not equate to fastest path. And that's a problem now that at internet scale, we're feeling, and that needs to get solved. So to me, the best thing that could come out of this is the technology that Google puts forward here isn't just adopted by other people, but that somehow it's standardized in a way that can be adopted globally as a normative thing. We're not just turning on BGP. We're using a new way to compute fastest path across the internet in a way that makes sense, which would be hard to do perhaps, but that's the point for me to take away. I'd love to see that happen.
And the other key piece is that they're doing those calculations not on the router, but separating it out and putting it into servers, a pool of servers to do that calculation. And there's a startup called Volta Networks is also trying a similar thing, more for the enterprise than Google scale.
Yeah, this is something that only at Google could do, or, you know, these super scale companies, technology companies, technology-centric companies could do. So it's interesting to see how they're doing it. I love the way that these companies do share it. Now, ultimately, the reason they share is financial. That is, they want to avoid recruiting by making themselves attractive to people. People go and apply to be, you know, part of Google because they get stars in their eyes. So just keep in mind what's the motivation for Google for talking about their competitive advantage.
All right, moving on. Cisco's Meraki unit has informed customers that a configuration error has resulted in the loss of some amount of user-uploaded data. That error affected a data center in North America. The register says some of this data includes interactive voice response menus, voicemail greetings, hold music, and logos. It's not really clear how much data was deleted, and Meraki's making an effort to recover it, but the company's most recent update reads, quote, "At this time, we do not expect to be able to recover most assets."
Oh, it was deleted.
It's not the fact that it was deleted. It's the fact that there's no backup. right? You've surely, you know, just because it's in the cloud doesn't mean you shouldn't be backing it up, right? And I think the point here is that not so much that it deleted, and I'm not going to point the finger and say that product is rubbish, because, but the fact is that if you're in the cloud, you still have to back up your data. You have to plan for failure. Just because it's in the cloud doesn't mean that it's immune from the problems. So I do notice that they've been posting updates to the dashboard about the thing, and apparently they're finding ways to recover the data. Maybe somebody's got a copy on their personal laptop or something. But, you know, not good, not a good look when, you know, the networking company whose job it is to do networking has made a big song and dance about being in the cloud and how awesome the cloud is and how much of a cloud company they are, and then they lose data, A, and B, can't restore it. And that's bad.
Yeah, all the worries about, I thought this was a privacy story, and then, you know, loses a bunch of customer data. Somehow I interpreted that headline to mean that
like
privacy
theft
had been breached. Yeah, and stuff had been given up. But no, in fact, it's just friggin' gone. Oh, so you upload all your stuff, you trust Meraki or whoever the vendor might have been, and then they lose it. That, as an enterprise consumer of putting all your stuff in the cloud, Greg, as you were just saying, that gives you pause, doesn't it? It's like, holy crap, mm-hmm. if my vendor does something unexpected, then I might lose stuff, and you don't really have control over that data. I mean, you as the end user could say you want to back that stuff up, and maybe there's a way that some customers could have backed that stuff up. But for the most part, I'm imagining they just trusted Cisco Meraki to mm-hmm. to have that data in hand and handled.
Yeah.
But again, the that Meraki can't go back in time and do some kind of a restoration seems bizarre to me. That seems,
well, it actually says here, the likelihood of a successful file recovery will vary depending on asset time. And at this time, we do not expect to be able to recover most assets. So pretty bad, right? Considering that you're paying quite a premium to do business with these companies, you do expect a premium level of service. And as I've said many times, I do not believe that our current premium providers, you know, the companies that we know and have trusted for many years, who tell us how awesome they are and how great they are, and you're paying a premium price to get our premium services, this is not premium. This is average, middle of the road. It should be much cheaper if I'm going to get this level of service. Yeah, type.
And Meraki really bills themselves as the easy button for networking, right? So yeah, it's very much supposed to be set it up, make it go, limited features. It works great with the things you want, but you're not supposed to have to think about this. It's just supposed to work.
And it is cosmetic, right? So mostly it's where people have customized their splash page or their interactive voice response menus or call groups and things like that. That's a big deal, because if you futzed with somebody's phones and now they're not working, that's a lot of workflows on people's desks. That's a problem. They haven't lost the networking data. They've lost metadata files around specific parts of the system. But anyway, if you've been impacted, you'll know why. My point is, if you're a big, professional, scary $50 billion company, you should have backups, cloud or no cloud.
Yeah, well, I agree. I 100% agree. But I also feel like, let those of you who have never made a configuration error cast the first stone. People make mistakes. No cloud provider is going to be 100% flawless. You have to understand that going in. Do your best practices, because mistakes happen, but everybody makes mistakes and it's a black eye, but.
Yeah, no, I agree. Absolutely. At a personal level, yes. But when you're talking about, you know, I'm reminded of the old saying, like, you know, to break things requires a person, to really break things requires a computer. Now, at this point, it's like, to break things in a small way requires a person, but to really, really break a lot of things for a lot of people requires a cloud. Got to have backups. There's no excuse for not having a backup here. Even if it was out for a day or two or three or four while they were restoring the data, still, they should have had a backup. There's no excuses here.
All right, just a brief pause while we talk about our sponsor, Nokia DeepField. DeepField from Nokia offers analytics and DDoS protection in real time for service providers. With Nokia DeepField, ISPs can improve the performance, security, and efficiency of their IP networks. And the Packet Pushers recently recorded a podcast with Dr. Craig Leibovitz to discuss how Nokia's DeepField solution provides analytics and insight across the cloud and IP networks for cost-effective network management in the age of cloud and IoT. If you listen to the podcast, you'll learn firsthand how one top-tier ISP is using DeepField's rich analytics to pinpoint and resolve network issues in moments, resulting in dramatic rise in their Netflix ISP speed index. This context-aware visibility is absolutely essential as encrypted traffic from cloud applications and services increasingly dominates bandwidth. Check out the podcast at packetpushers.net and learn more about Nokia DeepField at nokia.com today. And we'll have a link to that podcast in the show notes.
Yeah, it was an interesting show. You should definitely give it a listen, but this whole emerging field of analytics, like deep analytics, machine learning, using data from your network edge is really fascinating. I find it just hugely exciting just to know what's going on in my network for the first time.
Yeah, check out the podcast. Back to the news. A pair of Salesforce employees were fired after presenting about a homegrown security tool at DEF CON. The employees, who are part of an internal penetration testing team, were fired after they got off the stage, according to a story in ZDNet.
And these people deserve everything they've got.
Oh, really?
Look, when you work for a big American corporation like Salesforce.com, right, you do represent your employer even when you say you don't, right? Even if you stand up and say, I'm only speaking for myself, but while I was working for Salesforce, I did this, right? Guess who you speak for? It's the company that that you're enslaved to. So they stood up on stage and talked about a tool that they wrote internally, which is a malware creation tool. Not quite a malware creation, but it's an injection tool, a vulnerability injection tool that's designed for red team or hostile security penetration tool. And they called it Meat Pistol, right? So there's a problem right there. Like, that is like, bro, we've just totally got to have a name that's just like, you know, so 13 years old at high school type stuff.
Yeah, named by really? Children, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Well, I want to push back a little bit here, because according to the ZDNet report that broke this story, they did have permission to make the presentation. They cleared it internally, but there was sort of a last-minute pullback, wait, we shouldn't do this. They either didn't get the message or ignored it, but they initially did get sign-off. And Meat Pistol, I get it, it's a little juvenile, but it is an anagram of Metasploit, which is a well-known exploitation tool. So yes, a little juvenile, but it's also an insider joke.
Have you seen the whole presentation?
I have not seen the whole presentation. Is it?
Oh, it's juvenile from end to end. There's pictures of people urinating on things. There's toilets.
Oh,
there's...
well, it is DEF CON.
Yeah, right? It's like, it's just not at all like what you would call grown up behavior. Just completely childish at every single level. I think that what actually happened was Salesforce signed off and said to them, yeah, sure, you can go out there and... talk about this tool that you've created. We're right. And then sort of 4 months later, they realize they're going to stand up and they've seen the deck and they've gone, there's no way you can put that on stage and say that Salesforce is going to open to a source of code. Like, they've even got a picture of a porn person, like just the face of somebody who's obviously in a porn movie.
Okay. That I didn't know. That's a little,
right. It's not right. So my point is, like, so the talk, yes, was months in the planning. My guess is that they wrote this deck just like a bunch of kids in junior school going like, we've got so much fun. But, you know, you do represent your employer even when you don't and you speak for yourself. It does seem to me like Salesforce has said that they're not going to open source the code, and they've since been fired, and now they're going to sue Salesforce for making them unemployed. But, you know, look, security professionals, you're not listening. Nobody, you've never listened to anything anyway. You're all so wrapped up in your own selves that it doesn't really matter. But acting like a bunch of high school kids is not cool anymore. You look like idiots. If you act like idiots, you look like idiots, you're going to get treated like idiots. And security professionals, you earn your reputation as you are. And if you really want to be part of the future and get security taken seriously, you need to act seriously. And this is not it.
That's a good point about the content of the deck. I didn't look at that. This struck me initially as a clash of cultures between sort of the freewheeling security cowboys and cowgirls and more buttoned up executive types. And it seems like, given the content of the deck, I could see why an executive would be like, we do not want Salesforce's name attached to that stuff.
Yeah, you do not want your name attached to a deck which says, wouldn't it be nice if the malware was just super fucking awesome? And I mean, that's the nicest thing I can repeat here. The rest of the deck. Anyway, have a look at the deck. It's on the DEF CON site. You can go there. The link is in the show notes. Security people, act your age, not your shoe size, kids. Stop being male dicks, bro dudes, who think that, you know, sniggering and all that sort of stuff is fun. It's not. It's just stupid. Rant over.
Rant over. All right, sticking with security, HBO has reportedly offered a $250,000 bug bounty to the hackers who stole 1.5 terabytes of information from the entertainment company. The intruders who made off with the information have demanded a ransom of $6 million in Bitcoin. So HBO is trying to, I think, buy a little extra time or maybe lower the price significantly.
Is there that much Bitcoin in the world? I have no idea. Yeah.
Apparently, they said we need more time because we can't get our hands on that much Bitcoin.
Obviously, you haven't been tracking Bitcoin. Bitcoin's now up to $5,000, $5,000 per Bitcoin today.
Oh, 5,000. Last I knew, and this wasn't long ago, it was right around 2,500. So it's really a meteoric rise then.
Huge run up in the last period of time. Yeah. So Yeah, there's plenty of Bitcoin out there, because so there's no problem. I think the thing here is, obviously, this is HBO has been doing a lot of work on its security to make sure nobody can get at these movies, and they've gone to extreme situations. It was probably the editing suite or the editing company that was had a lot of these movies. They didn't actually make off from HBO, but they've got a bunch of stuff, including personal details about the actors and a large number of HBO employees, according to the background research. Now, HBO is in a difficult situation here, because if the movies leak out, it ruins some of their plans for the impact. They think that having secrets about their shows is bad for their business, whether it is or isn't unknown. HBO now has to decide whether it wants to pay a ransom of roughly $6 million. Now, if you do pay, then what actually happens is every hacker crew around the world is going to attack you.
Exactly.
Right? Because once it's known that you're paying, you're a target. And they're going to try and cash in on someone who's known to pay out. And you've got a difficult situation. You don't want to lose the revenue of one movie. You certainly don't want to be attacked by every single hacker crew from around the world thinking, there's a payoff here. Clear the decks, boys. We're going in. It's HBO. You know,
HBO is in an interesting position, because they're worried that their extremely popular show, Game of Thrones, which, if you're following the books or the show, we're in uncharted territory. Nobody knows how the story is playing out until the actual episodes are released. And if it can get pre-released, yes, HBO is worried about maybe spoiling some of the splash of releasing it themselves. I agree, though, they should not pay this ransom. It would set a bad precedent. It would be a bad move. And what's to stop them from releasing the content anyway, even if HBO does cough up 6 million in bitcoins?
Yeah, exactly. And then keep in mind, too, that in the US, the courts and the police system is so underfunded these days that they don't have a whole lot of resources to prosecute these cases, right? So it's very expensive to create a global task force. So if you want to start attacking the source of these hackers wherever they are in the world, you're going to have a tough time convincing the police to allocate 150 to 100 resources to prevent a miscarriage of justice when it's just a movie company, right? But of course, you know, maybe HBO's got some nice donations going on in Washington, and you could think perhaps they've got access to the ears of the government and could get a police response. But I don't think this, you're going to get too far with this. Hard, hard, hard.
And if the hackers do release details about Game of Thrones and our listeners happen to find out about them, please don't tell me. I don't want any spoilers.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Greg, you found a story about TIA, and they have got a new standard for cabling. What is going on here?
So just because we live in an era of software defined all the time, cabling is still a thing, right?
Who needs cables? It's all software.
It's all software. So the TIA is a telecommunication industry authority who specialize in defining what cable standards are sort of out there. Now, it's one of those unique members-only for-profit type of standards bodies that's unique to the American culture. So the ANSI is the institute that sponsors the TIA, the American National Standards Institute. And in true American style, standards should cost you money. You shouldn't just get them given to you. They should be costing you money to access them. So unfortunately, I can't get onto the standards and see what's new and what's whatever it is. But everybody sort of, I'm sort of looking at it and going like, whenever you have to pay for standards, it's sort of, you sit there and go like, who's making the money here? Why are they choosing, you know, I think there's a motivation problem, but hey, what do I know? So I can't give you a reference to the source, because apparently cabling standards are worth money. But basically, it does things like add 16 and 32 fiber MPO style array connectors as an additional connector type for the termination of more than two fibers. Wow. So 2010. So, like all good things cable, history is the modern standard. You know, so there you go.
Ethan, that was exactly my response to a story about cabling.
It's obviously necessary, but yes, yeah. It's a little difficult to get excited and mystifying to me why such a thing would be behind wraps.
Like, here's another great one here. Adds OM5 as an allowed fiber type. Allowed. as if a TIA standard was going to stop you, right? Adds Category 8 as an allowed type of balanced twisted cable.
When I saw the acronym TIA, I thought maybe the A would stand for association, but they went with authority. That's a heavy word. Yep. That's
Telecommunications Industry Association.
It is association. Okay, so not authority.
It is association.
Maybe we should start the PPNA, the Packet Pushers Networking Authority.
Really.
Put some sting
like
in our
tip. Pushes. Yeah, heavy industries.
Heavy industries, yeah.
Heavy industry is still
the perennial favorite.
Yes, so there you go. If you care about TIA, go and rub up against your TIA sources and see if you can find out what's new. It's not very exciting, but there you go.
And Ethan, you were recently at a Tech Field Day event where you got a briefing on Aruba and their new 8400 core switch.
Yeah, 2 days ago, I was out at Aruba's Palatial headquarters, and I do mean Palatial. They are lovely, brand new facility where they announced the 8400. It is a campus core switch. And let me give you the rundown. So it is a super chassis switch designed for the campus core. It's not really for your data center. They built this thing with an anticipated chassis life of about 10 years, and they were citing the venerable Catalyst 6500 as an example of what customers want. We can argue about that in a bit, but let me keep going on the specs on this thing. They're going after customers, K-12, higher ed, industrial, really anybody that's got a large building supporting hundreds or thousands of people. You want a big beast in the middle of your core. This is your switch, is what they're saying here. It took them 2 years to build it from conception to product, which I was surprised at just how quick it took to build this thing. Because you remember, historically, it would be 5, even 7 years sometimes to figure out a product, what you wanted it to be, and then make the thing. 2 years from nothing to here it is. And the ProCurve BU is behind this thing. If you're trying to figure out in the Aruba networking world, what's HPE, what's Aruba, where did all these things come together? Is it all now? Well, it's all under that Aruba brand name, but if you care, the ProCurve BU was behind this thing. They aren't telling us what the ASIC is that's underneath the hood here, other than, yeah, it's a merchant ASIC, but they were very tight-lipped about it.
You want to have a guess? Let's have a guess. Let's play games. Let's play games.
We all spent time guessing. I mean, whatever. They didn't say. They couldn't say.
Everything points to a refresh of some of the chipsets from Broadcom that we won't name. Because Broadcom refreshes, we saw the Trident 3 recently, so there must be refreshes for the Jericho and Julian coming. So that's probably what's in it.
Put that on the prediction list.
Oh, hang on, I'll get the spreadsheet out. There you go. Jesus, that's dusty. Yeah, bad. Yeah. Let's see, HPE. Go. Keep going, Ethan.
No matter what we speculate the ASIC is, we don't actually know what it is. They wouldn't tell us. We actually, those of us that were at the presentation, pulled the cards out of the physical chassis they showed us and looked, hoping to get a glimpse. But no, the line card was shrouded by metal and a heat sink, of course, and we would have had to take tools to the thing to look at that chip and wouldn't have been kind. They didn't really want us to be doing that kind of stuff. okay, so the 8400, I'll just keep running down the specs here so you get a sense of this thing. It's designed to be quote-unquote carrier grade, although I asked them, so if it's so awesome, do I still have to buy two of them? And they're like, oh, yes, you will need two of them or maybe even four of them. And we all slapped thighs and hugged, and yes, you still need two of them. It's super secure, so it's trusted platform module, meaning you need valid certificates for hardware to boot and for OS components to load, or the thing doesn't come online.
Let me just ask about that. What you're actually saying is that the hardware has to carry a certificate in, so you can't just put any hardware in? So there's some supply chain certification going on here.
Exactly right. Yep. Right. So the supply chain certification and then software certs as well for things like the operating system. Yeah, kind of like the Skyport Systems hardware, if you remember that box that was they launched a year and a half ago.
That's unique because if you're trying to get into high security environments and you're saying, I can give you certified hardware, that is, I can actually validate that this was genuine, not OEM'd, or there's a lot of black market Cisco hardware flowing into the market. And the assumption is that some of it's been trojaned or backdoored by malicious actors.
I think it's a very big deal. Yeah, I think they made a big deal about it, talking about it, and it is a big deal for the right customer. Other people might look at it and be a little scared because if this thing doesn't pass validation process, you cannot bring this box online, and it's your core switch. So my brain went to thoughts of, well, what happens if your certificate authority validation chain is smashed in some way? Even though you have valid certificates, you just can't get a validation through. You can't bring the box up potentially. So that, then again, this thing's probably not going to get rebooted all that often. So whatever, it's things to be considered. But on the whole, yeah, very important feature and well worth having. Because of what you're saying, it demonstrates that this is a valid box that was through a trusted supply chain. It's a beast. 8 rack units, 240 pounds if it's fully loaded. You've got slots for 8 line cards, 3 fabric modules, 2 management modules, and it's 1025, 40, 100 gigabit Ethernet. It pushes something around 20 terabits per second. I forget exactly how much. And that is all through those fabric cards. So you can lose a fabric card and keep forwarding, but you lose some capacity. And then control plane CPU is more typical for what you see today, a little bit beefier than the olden days. You get a quad-core Xeon running at 2 gigahertz, 32 gig of RAM in a 16x2 config. That's the chassis. They intend for you to bolt this thing into the rack and let it sit there and rot for 10 years and then just keep swapping out hardware. And so we'll see if customers really want to do that. We can have a chat about it at some point. Aruba operating system, the Aruba OS-CX is, I think, the hardware is the hardware, right? It's fine. But the OS was really the thing that grabbed my attention. Modular, sitting on Linux, a Linux distro that Aruba created themselves with Yocto. And you can get at the shell and do whatever the heck you want, including shoot yourself in the foot and do really dumb things. I mean, you've got full capability to do what you like.
I like double-barrel foot guns.
Yes, lovely feature. But it did demonstrate the power of it. I mean, you want to hop in there and run a TCP dump against a interface that's on the box. You can absolutely do that. That feature and functionality is there for you. The OS, everything talks to a state database. So all daemons, all the routing daemons, anything that's got to do with forwarding, state of the system, interfaces, et cetera, they all talk to with this state database. And that is all done via modified OVSDB. That they are upstreaming their modifications to OVSDB, but they needed to modify OVSDB to have it behave the way they needed it to behave. The OS is all API driven from the get-go. Well, what are the APIs? Oh, we're not going to, you know, tell you about that exactly. You have to ask and so on. Fully documented right there in the GUI. There's a Swagger interface that lets you browse all the APIs and their capabilities. There's a CLI, you know, which they listening to them describe the CLI was a riot because they very carefully avoided saying it was industry standard. But then other things they said made you feel like, okay, it's a Cisco clone of some kind, although they never said that. We're very, very wordsmithed how they described it.
Wonder why.
Exactly. Giggle, giggle. Yeah. And oddly, the CLI is not an API consumer, which I assumed that it would be, but no, it is not. It does things a little differently anyway. And then Python. You can manage this OS with Python, and they've even got their own Python modules that they've written to hasten that process. And they spent a lot of time talking about the different things you can do with Python and custom code. That is all tied into their integrated network analytics and root cause analysis engine. So you can run Python scripts on the box. You can monitor all kinds of interesting things on the box. You basically have full access to the hardware through Linux. They've got their own ASIC driver that they wrote that lets you get at anything. And then Python modules to make it even easier. This box running these network analytics detects any sort of anomaly. They're supposed to be detected automatically. And then the root cause determined. And they gave some demos of that that looked, made it feel real to me. But nascent, like, you know, here's a few example scripts, things we've come up with, and they've opened it up to the community. So I suspect there's going to be some really clever and interesting things that come out of the community for this box. Licensing, they did it right. It's one tier. You buy it, you get everything. It's no, oh, did you want to route with this box? That'll be,
I was watching them and they talked about it and I was going like, oh, yay, not death by licensing.
Exactly.
Like, you know, it's like one of the things that we see people talk about on Cisco in particular, because that's the one where people complain the loudest, is just they don't even know. One person told me the other day that they had to buy a maintenance contract for the license upgrade.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
That's just a kick in the teeth.
Yeah. And it was like, wow. And he said, yeah, I just wasted 24 hours working out that they wouldn't sell me the license until I'd bought a maintenance contract for the license. But the license itself was an upgrade to a feature set, which drove up the maintenance pricing, and they had to order both at the same time. But it took Cisco and the reseller and the customer 3 days to work that out. He was not happy, as you might have assessed. You know.
Well, this box seems aimed at ease of use and flexibility, so you can do what you want with it. It is out of the Pro Vision family, like the daemons, OSPF, and so on. They're not, if you're thinking, oh, Linux, so it must be like Quagga or free range routing. It's like, no, it's actually all code out of the Pro Vision family that was modified for this box. And it is orderable today. They're going to start mass production, you know, very soon. So the vibe I got was they kind of want to know how many orders they're going to get and then place their order at the factory. They're not just going to be like, I would like a million of them. They're gonna make an educated guess based on inbound customer interest, how many to order, and then get that production ramped up. But you can definitely order it today. I thought it was a heck of a box, to be honest. I mean, if you're going to stick with the chassis switch and, you know, rack it for 10 years and you want something that's flexible and does a lot of stuff for you, it's a really interesting platform, I felt.
Yeah, I do. So, you know, we chatted about this in the Slack channel as they were talking, and I do feel that there are places, like, you know, there are places where the 6500 chassis switch lives, like on U.S. Navy. You know, a lot of their boats, IT infrastructure is built around that chassis, and there are holes in the boat literally designed for where that box goes. And it does sit there for 20 years. And I'm also thinking of factories. So when we talk about IoT, we're talking about large numbers of IoT devices inside of factories where Wi-Fi may not be practical. So there is definitely a market for it. The question is, how big of a market? Can you really justify a big hoo-ah, you know, chassis that's going to attract enough business to make that worthwhile?
Yeah, because if I'm a different sort of a customer, I may be more interested in a fixed configuration switch that's cheap, maybe doesn't do, you know, a million things, but I can still build redundancy in with, say, a leaf spine design in my campus core, and refresh it every 3 years, let's say, rather than a chassis I'm married to with a hole in my rack for 10. So,
yeah, I just was, you know, it just seems like, you know, we've talked plenty of times about being able to build campus with one RU using, you know, ECMP style network designs. And it does sort of feel a bit out of place. But then again, when you think about it, maybe tomorrow the era of IoT and the era of mega devices all over the data center, maybe that does that change the way things look in some way that I don't, you know, maybe I just don't understand.
Well, it goes back to your earlier point. There are certain environments where this box slates in perfectly. You're going to want this exact kind of a box. And, you know, they made the point that the 10-year isn't just hardware. It's also software. It's also the flexibility that they've built into this thing. You can customize it for your environment. And even as your environment changes, this is going to be able to go with it rather than being, you know, well, a box like the Catalyst 6500, you know, running monolithic iOS, where this is it and this is how it does what it does. And operationally, you're married to this way of doing things. You, with all the, you know, APIs and Python and modules and, you know, built-in analytics, you get the sense that, huh, I could kind of do anything with this box if I made the investment in making it work the way I needed it to work. And that would roll with you as your business changed over time. Mm. So my point being, it wasn't just the hardware built for the long haul, which, you know, anybody can do that if you got to build a chassis. We've known how to do it for a long time. Mm. It's the OS that has changed as well. Oh, and by the way, they are talking about that Aruba OS-CX making its way into other Aruba networking products over time, which also seems like a really interesting move.
Yeah, that'll be a political bun fight. That's not a, yeah. That's one of those things. You know. Yeah, I sort of felt that the box was, part of it looked like something from 10 years ago, and part of it looked really modern in terms of the internal architecture, in the sense that it's a fairly modern chassis architecture, and they've done some smart stuff around the airflow. Like, they've got a lot of fans in there or something, haven't they?
Yeah, they've got the whole rack, the whole back of the thing is filled with fans, and there's things that, like, you pull a line card out and a spring-loaded baffle comes in place to make sure that airflow is still optimized. You're not wasting air in an empty slot, you know, these sorts of things that were very, very clever and well thought out, and then optimized for that 8RU form factor. Things like the fabric cards are hidden behind a fan tray. You pop out the fan tray, now you can get at those fabric cards, which saved them an RU. So sort of a big deal. And clever thinking, as you put it, a modern chassis that was well thought out.
Yeah, well, at least they've learned lessons of the mistakes we made in previous years. So, yeah, looks pretty nice if you want a chassis. I just can't – maybe we should have a debate one day, Ethan, about stacking versus stacking 1RU boxes, virtual and physical stacking, and then chassis versus what we're seeing – Lisp, like Cisco Software Defined Access, is doing with the Lisp overlay SDN style, which kind of uses overlay networks to just make all that a bit redundant. And the SDN means you still only got one point of configuration.
It's a line that's being drawn between what you would normally or traditionally build as a network engineer versus you're kind of getting hands off on what's going on under the hood, because a lot of it's just handled for you and you interact with the GUI, I think is a line we're seeing drawn here.
Ethan, do you have a sense of the perception among yourself and the delegates about, is this even a good idea for Aruba to be investing resources, development, sales in pushing a box like this when they're primarily known as your wireless vendor?
Well, this is more about branding, right? So, yes, Aruba is still... Well, so for example, I asked one of the execs before the main presentation, there's a lot of confusion around your switching product lines, guys. You know, which, what am I supposed to be buying for which purposes? Because as we mentioned, HPE has got a an alliance now with Arista, with Big Switch Networks and with others. So you've got the Alta line product set. You've got what was traditionally the ProCurve. You've got the Aruba, et cetera, and then the Comware, the stuff that runs Comware. How do you know what goes where? And they are really working hard to fix that. In fact, they were a little frustrated that people still had those questions. They're like, man, we've been working really hard to try to, you know, help people understand that. And so this product isn't tied to...
if they've been working really hard, it hasn't got to me.
Well, that's that's the impression they have, is they think they've been pushing messaging hard to help people understand this. But the Aruba branding is fresh. And I think there's a lot of people that still have yet to realize, oh, when I hear Aruba, the first thing I think of shouldn't be Wi-Fi necessarily. It should be HPE enterprise switching, you know, all unified under that one brand. And I think there's time to...
You know who's going
to
go for this product is the U.S. federal government. They're going to be all over it because... The certified supply chain, it's built in America, designed by HPE. It's got a lot of features in it that government wants, you know, that buy once, keep for decades type stuff.
That
it's the same
up.
As what you've already got.
And that was part of the security, you know, the hardware security and the TPM and so on was driven by hoping to get some federal sales. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And the 6500 really isn't, you know, was built in a different time. You know, in the mid-90s was when it was designed. The first of those chassis was designed, and security wasn't, like device integrity and supply chain integrity wasn't a thing. And a lot of those things, systems are going to need to be replaced fairly soon. Yeah, good for them. It was a good presentation too. They did a good job of it.
They crushed it, actually. It was extremely well done, especially for the audience. So if you go up to YouTube and search for Tech Field Day and find the presentations, if you're interested in such a chassis, they go through everything from hardware design to, you know, chassis and the software architecture. It's really a nice deep dive.
And we can put a link to that in the show notes. All right, wrapping up, we've got a surfing dog story. If you've ever watched your local news, they like to wrap up their shows with little personal interest stories. This one is coming from Hewlett Packard Enterprises. They are sending a supercomputer into space.
Hey, space, space, space. Sorry, I just had to do that. Yeah, so they've launched a supercomputer into space on the next SpaceX Dragon spacecraft. The link is in the show notes if you want to see it. And it's a year-long experiment to see if the – it's not really a supercomputer, by the way. It's an SGI box. So if you read carefully, it's a computer. It'd be a high-performance computer perhaps, but they're going to be sending it up into space to see if it can last in space. They're not really – one of the things about computers that have previously gone into the space, if they've been made – very, very hardened and made radiation proof and blah, blah, blah proof. And they spend a lot of money customizing them. And so it takes like 20 years to make a computer space ready. And that's obviously not going to work if you're going to start putting a mission to Mars in 5 years' time. So basically what they're saying is, why don't we just package one up, soak it in, drop it into a liquid medium for cooling and to keep it safe from the radiation and everything. And let's send it up for a year and see if it works. So I think a couple of interesting things there is, because SpaceX is changing the pricing for getting a machine into space, for getting payloads into space, it's now possible to actually just put a computer into a test platform like a liquid bath and then send it to space and see if it works. That's not something we've ever been able to do before. They've always had to spend years and years, and you only get one shot. There's only like one rocket going every 6 months, and the payloads are sold out 20 years in advance. So it's interesting sort of effect where if you can cheapen the price, if you can reduce the price of something, new markets emerge. And that's a story I've been telling around technology for quite some time. We need to find ways to lower the cost of our technology so we can do new ways of doing things.
Cool. Well, we'll have the link to the press release if you want to go get more details about a computer in space.
Yes, we always want one of those. So this is a chance for us to talk about the Packet Pushers membership. If you're not a member already, you could become a free member of packetpushers.net/members. Now, once you sign up today, you'll get access to our link propagation and our human infrastructure newsletters. We have over 2,500 people in the membership system today, which is quite something, really. Thanks everybody very much to everybody who signed up. But if you're not a member, just go over to packetpushers.net/member. All we ask for is your first name, last name, and your email address. And we only need the first name and the last name to do spam detection. It's really not for anything else. So just make it look relatively honest, and that'll be good enough for us. We don't actually want your real name because we don't actually care that much about you, to be fair. So love to be part of the membership. We've got plans for the membership coming up in the future. There'll be more stuff coming as we get it produced and get it activated.
That's right. There'll be more coming, but initially you get two newsletters. They're free. So sign up at packetpushers.net/members, and you can also just go there and look at the benefits. That does wrap up this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
You can find me writing on the Packet Pushers. I'm also trying to get more YouTube done. I bought some more technology toys for my camera gear, so hopefully I might get some more YouTube done. But of course, and I'm also microblogging on my personal technical site at etherealmind.com.
Ethan, how about you?
I am at EC Banks on Twitter, where I tweet occasionally ephemeral tweets. I do delete them from time to time. Ha ha! Gotcha. You didn't see that coming, did you? I also blog personally about new media and so on at ethancbanks.com. But most of my tech blogging is at packetpushers.net.
I'm Drew Conroy Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM. I never delete a tweet because I want them to survive after I've departed this plane. And I also blog at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our sponsor, Nokia Deep Field, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with your friends. And to get more fine, free technical podcasts, just surf on over to packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.